For NPR News, I'm Greg Eklund.
The Division I NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament is moving into the Sweet 16 today. Notably, Caitlin Clark and her Iowa Hawkeyes are playing Colorado this afternoon. The men's Elite Eight games are this weekend as well. Illinois playing UConn in the early game this evening, and then Clemson plays Alabama. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
Good morning to you. It is Easter weekend type weather here. It's pretty clear outside. Temperatures are going to get up near 60. Right now, about 49 degrees on the Augustana College campus. But friends, you're just in time for a conversation with this week's guest, Mark Smith. That's ahead. I'm Kai Swanson. I hope you're going to join us here on Quad Cities Public Radio as we while away the hour, check in on the composer's date book, and who knows what else. All ahead on Saturday Morning Live, portions recorded. Oh, the lovely music that tells us it's Saturday morning once again. We've made it through another week, and now we're looking forward to a holiday weekend. And I'm so grateful that my guest is Mark Smith, a retired judge from Scott County. And I've been looking forward to this for a long time. We had a chance to just hang out with you, Mark. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me, Kai. This is a great... That music reminded me of what... I listened to when I was cleaning the bathroom, usually on Saturday morning, listening to Don Wooten. So,
well, it's chores music, right? A lot of times the shows that I love on Saturdays and Sundays, Weekend Edition, very much a part of that, and Scott Simon, and it's just great stuff, but it accompanies doing those things that we have to do on Saturdays and Sundays as we get ready for stuff. But I want everybody to know, Don appeared to have a great birthday. Wootenmas was earlier in March, and he let the cat out of the bag through his column, so 95, and it was fun visiting with him a little bit earlier in the month, and we look forward to his weekly column. Now, I know they run that in the Dispatch Argus, but Mark, I assume you're a Quad City Times reader. Do they run that in the Times as well?
They do. I read that every Sunday.
Yeah.
So it's always interesting.
He's always got good stuff.
Yeah, reading his article about aging was really interesting a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I imagine he's got a bit of expertise there.
I think so.
And then the previous week, he did a great one sort of on conceptions of the divine. And that's what I always loved about working with Don as a young snot-nosed reporter, is if you were, I mean, the newsroom was open over most holidays if they fell during the week. And we would get some great visitors who would just come by to say hi to Don and see what's going on. And I remember one of my favorites of those was, I think it was over a Christmas break or somewhere in there. And then Congressman Jim Leach came and had a great conversation. And there were those of us who were just kind of sitting around the edges listening in as Wooten and Jim Leach were chatting. Those were some great moments.
Yeah, they were.
Try to capture those whenever we can. But now I want to get right to the heart of the matter and find out, who the heck is Mark Smith? I know a few things about you, but not that many. I do know that you are a graduate of one of the two finest college preparatory high schools in the Quad Cities, Davenport Central, right?
True,
and I put that up there with Rocky as being great college prep schools. But how did you make your way to Central? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up at 15th and Warren in Davenport. I had eight siblings, and it was a great neighborhood. Lots of kids had a great time playing outdoors and so forth. I went to parochial school about five blocks away, and it was a great experience. So,
what was the school?
Holy Family.
Holy Family.
Yeah, it was... let's see, Fillmore and 17th, I believe.
Yeah, I think it's no longer...
No longer there.
Right. But I know the neighborhood that you're talking about. It seems like a great neighborhood to grow up in, because those neighborhoods that were sort of on and along the hill, especially at the lower end, those tended to be more interesting neighborhoods.
Yes, they were.
Yeah. And you weren't too far from Fejervary then, right?
Yeah, that's where I took swimming lessons.
Hey.
My mother had us do swimming lessons during June, and we called it the blue lip period because the water was so cold
so freezing cold.
You were shivering all the way home. And we walked there, so.
Well, and I'm not trying to make light at all of it. I really do think that Davenport Central is a great college prep school because I remember going over there and getting involved in stuff where teachers like Larry Minard would bring people over to talk about, you know, democracy and all this and journalism and everything. So what were some memories that you have from Davenport Central that got you thinking about college and higher ed?
Well, actually, when I first started Central High School, I wasn't much interested in academics. I was coming from a family of nine kids. I was mostly interested in trying to earn enough money to make ends meet in terms of preparing to go to college. But slowly, after I took a few subjects, the first academic person that I really knew was a person called Elihu Cooper. He was my Latin teacher.
Wow.
And he had a PhD from Harvard. He was Phi Beta Kappa. And I was wondering why he ended up in Davenport, Iowa, teaching high school. Well, his wife was from this area, and but he was the first one that got me interested in academics. So it was a great experience.
Well, I'm glad to know another Elihu. I think there's only about three that I've ever run into in history. They're all interesting folks, at least the ones that I've bumped into, and that sounds like another one.
He certainly was.
And that got you thinking about it, huh? So now, obviously, you were eventually going to make your way towards the law. When did that come onto your radar screen?
Well, I went to St. Ambrose.
Uh-huh.
I walked to school since it was only about five blocks away.
Yeah.
And the political science always interested me, and that's what I majored in. And Doc McMahon and Doc Norton were two great influencers in my desire to know more about the law. Doc McMahon was an expert in international law. And when I was going there, he encouraged me to read about the law, and that's when I first became interested, maybe moving on from there.
Yeah.
There's not much of a market for political science majors when I graduated in 1972.
All right.
They encouraged me to move on, and that's what I did. I went applied at various law schools and ended up at St. Louis University.
Really? I didn't realize that you went to SLU.
Yes, it was a fine Jesuit institution.
It still is. And in fact, one of my best friends from this institution on the other side of the creek went there for law school, and he's a judge in St. Louis. But he's from a family that's been there for generations up on the hill. So it was natural for him to hang out and stay there in St. Louis.
That was my first big city experience, too.
Really?
I'd never flown on a plane, and I didn't until after law school. But that was the first time, given the location of the university, which is right in the middle of St. Louis.
You bet.
It was a little iffy coming home from the library at 10 o'clock at night, and you had to be careful.
Yeah, Well, you know, my son, and it's a great institution. It's in a great neighborhood. Wash U down there as well, another fine school. My son, when he was looking at colleges, was looking at some really big city schools. And I said, well, just remember one thing, buddy, that when you're in a big city, I mean, part of your attentiveness has to be to the surroundings and, you know, and your, you know, personal safety and security. That's true wherever you go. But if you, that was one of the things that I think argues for a school in a smaller community is that you can, you know, be in a little bit more sequestered area. But yeah.
Yeah. St. Louis, it's like any other big city.
It's
really an interesting area. I've really learned a lot just by living in a big city. I lived in a dorm for the first year, but second, third year, it was an apartment and, going to the Hill for Italian food and so forth, going to the baseball games downtown old stadium, and it was a good experience.
Okay, so you went there for law school. When you started, I mean, those were heady days in the early 70s, and with what was going on with Watergate, there was a lot of suspicion around politics, public administration, and dare I say it, even the law. So what were things that were calling to you in terms of the direction your legal career was going to take?
We did a lot of interning. We were allowed to go downtown and watch trial lawyers. Mm-hmm. The summer after my second year, we worked. A friend of mine and I worked at legal aid in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, really?
And we did that for the summer. That's also where I got to observe some really good lawyers do litigation. They allowed me to go downtown and watch the performances, and I saw both good and bad lawyers. And I learned a lot more from the bad lawyers, I think, than I did from the good ones.
So. Absolutely, absolutely.
So trial work was my interest.
Were you with a firm in Cincinnati?
No, legal aid.
Legal aid. That's why you said that. Yeah, right, right. Yeah, absolutely. You right. said that. I was thinking I had a friend who was on the Augustana board for many, many years. He was with the Taft Stettinius law firm. And I think if your name is Taft and you're in Ohio, that's probably got a little cachet to it.
So. Yeah, pretty good law firm.
So then but when you were in St. Louis, if you were looking at cases, I just love the architecture of that civil courts building, which sort of has a ziggurat built mm-hmm. on the top as a bit of a nod to, you know, the Code of Hammurabi, I guess. Mm-hmm. Did you ever get inside there?
I did. Yeah. I don't recall how I got there and what I watched, but the first trial I watched was a trial on constructing a barricade and how the individual got injured by constructing a barricade, just a regular street barricade, which to me was interesting. How would you injure yourself making a... But he did. So, and I don't know what the verdict was because we just saw parts of the trial. So,
well, and then, so then when it was time to then start your law career, did you immediately come back to your hometown or did you look around farther afield? Or
no, my roommate was from Minnesota and he always encouraged me to try the Twin Cities. Mm. And in 1975, the economy wasn't the greatest.
No, it wasn't.
But I still drove up there and tried to find a job. And I did some freelance work for various firms, including my former roommate's firm. After a year of looking and freelancing, I decided that the Twin Cities wasn't for me, and mainly because I didn't know anybody when I first went up there other than my former roommate. And getting a job is who you know.
Exactly.
It always has been, and to me, always will be. And I wasn't number one in my class, so I didn't have that academic ability. So I came back here.
Yeah.
And I was not disappointed to come back here. So.
And it was a place where you knew some people.
I did.
Yeah. So you remind me of my favorite line in all the years in higher education that I've worked. There's one line from a commencement speech that stands head and shoulders above all others. And that was Peter Gomes, the dean of the Harvard Chapel, who had this wonderful patrician accent. And he said, "Remember, graduates, it is not who you know. It is whom you know." And I thought that was the best advice any graduate's ever gotten right there in a nutshell.
Yeah.
So, but you come back here, and then you mentioned this is 75, and for some reason I flashed on when you said the economy. Do you remember WIN buttons, whip inflation now?
Yes, I do.
And they did as much to curb inflation then as anything anybody's ever tried since.
inflation was raging.
Oh, it was crazy.
In the late 70s, early 80s, as I recall.
Yeah, but it was Ford. Gerald Ford, who came up with the whip inflation now buttons. Yeah. And well, it eventually calmed down. Okay, so you come back to this area. And again, where do you find yourself starting the law career? What kinds of work were you doing?
Well, my dad was a salesman downtown. He sold furniture for Leith Furniture.
Oh, sure.
And so he knew pretty much everybody. He usually had coffee at Bishop's Buffet, and he was sitting down there having coffee with the then clerk of court, Dave Dahlin. And Dave said, "Well, the county's authorized a new position for clerking for the county judges." And there were county judges back then, not state court judges.
Yes.
So that's I went and applied. And Judge Lowell Phelps, for some reason, decided that I'd be a good person to get into that job. And that was my first job as in the legal profession.
Wow.
$10,000 a year. That's what was hired at. Yeah, it was in the money.
That's right. That was big time.
It was.
Well, did you stay then in that court system, or did you get into any other areas?
When I was clerking for the judges, did a lot of the research for, I think that back then there were like 8 judges in the district, they rotated to 5 different counties. So I got to know all the judges and learning from the judges what was impressive to them and what wasn't really gave me a leg up when I started practicing law. Because, again, I got to sit in on a lot of trials, watch really good lawyers and watch not so good lawyers. And that's what really enthralled me about trial practice. Because that's where that's where it was at. I did some practice when I, after 18 months of being a law clerk, I started in a small firm that did general practice, real estate, probate, trial, court-appointed criminal defense. Mm-hmm. And I did that for about 2 years. That was my first trial experience as a they didn't have a public defender's office here. They hired private attorneys through the public defender's office and at a certain rate. And back then it was $35 an hour is what they hired defense attorneys.
My goodness.
Yeah. So again, I was in the money back
then. Hey, Roland. I love it. So that must have been a broad, expansive experience that you got. When did this notion of being a judge come on your radar screen? Or was it one of those things where the fickle finger of fate just simply pointed at you? How did that come about?
When I clerked for the judges, I always thought that they were very astute on what they thought was the proper way of deciding cases. And I was very interested in their thought processes. Mm-hmm. And back then, most of the judges had a good work ethic, and they looked at the facts and applied the law in a very judicious manner. And so I was always interested in what judges did. And I thought it'd be an honor once I practiced law long enough, that I should apply. And I practiced law for 23 years, 3 of which was a prosecutor for the Scott County Attorney's Office. Mm. And I did everything from advising the Board of Supervisors to second chairing murder trials. And that's where I got most of my trial experience. I probably did over 100 jury trials during that time. That was a good way to get the experience I needed to really do what I thought was at least an adequate job as a trial attorney.
Yeah.
And I went from that firm to another sole practitioner, shared office with him, mm-hmm. and then went to another firm and did pretty much the same thing for 23 years. And after 23 years, chief judge was going to retire. Before that, another judge retired and I applied. And, mm-hmm. For some reason, the commission thought I should be one of the two that went up in front of the governor.
Huh.
And the guy I went up with, Hobie Darbyshire, was an excellent judge. He had judicial experience before I did.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, well, this will be an interesting experience. And Hobie got it, and as very justifiably, because he had the wealth of experience. I was really honored by the fact the commission nominated me. Back then, we had 24 applicants for that position because they thought it's an honor to be nominated.
Sure.
And so I decided that next opening, I'd try again.
And then it happened.
And then it happened. The chief judge retired, and people encouraged me to reapply, both people on the commission and my colleagues. And again, they nominated me and another individual. And I went up to the governor, and Governor Branstad, mm-hmm. One of the questions he asked at the end was, do you have anything in your background that will embarrass me? I said, not to my knowledge.
Yeah, I love a good answer. Yes. Nothing comes to mind.
Yes.
Well, I'm so grateful that you did that and that you became a judge. And we're going to talk about that a little bit in advance coming up here in a moment. But first, you know, we love to judge all kinds of things. And now we get to judge whether or not we think this week's Composer's Datebook is worth a listen.
This is the Composer's Datebook for March 30th. I'm John Burge. Call me Ishmael Burge. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, then I account it high time to get to the nearest Starbucks as soon as I can. With apologies to Herman Melville, today marks the anniversary of the opening of the first Starbucks coffee shop in Seattle. Now, since Starbucks gets its name from the first mate of the Pequod, the whaling ship made famous in Melville's classic novel Moby Dick, today we celebrate composer Jake Heggie's ambitious Moby Dick opera, which premiered in Dallas in 2010. When I write an opera, at a certain point, the characters start singing to me, Jake Heggie said about wrestling with his great white whale. But this was the first piece where I felt there was a physical cost, an exhaustion. Moby Dick deserved that. And no doubt the Dallas Opera stage director, Leonard Folia, needed more than a few cups of Mr. Starbucks coffee to bring Melville's epic drama to life on stage. He said, I had to sink the ship in 8 bars of music. Composer's Datebook is produced by APM, American Public Media, in collaboration with the American Composers Forum, reminding you that all music was once new.
Support for WVIK's Composer's Datebook comes from Quad City Symphony Orchestra, where access meets inspiration. The QCSO seeks to inspire, entertain, and engage the entire Quad Cities community through music, music education, and cultural leadership. And you can learn more at qcso.org. I don't know if that's going to increase my appreciation of the next time I go to Starbucks, knowing all that background about, Call Me Ishmael and that particular opera. But I will say, friends, that if you haven't gotten your tickets yet for the QCSO's final Masterworks concert of this season, that's coming up next weekend, please do so. Yes, of course, it's got Brahms' Tragic Overture. Yes, of course, it's got Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony. But it also will have our premiere of Jacob Banks' Clarinet Concerto. And I've been this is really kind of fun. I mean, because obviously people don't follow this the way they do the March Madness. But this commission was also included the Philadelphia Orchestra and the United States Marine Band. And the Philadelphia performance has garnered these incredible reviews for a local composer, Jacob Banks, who's right here in our midst. Also right here in our midst is my guest this week, Mark Smith, a retired judge in Scott County, who is telling us all about this wonderful legal career that he built up. And Mark, thanks again for being with us.
It's an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you today is I do want to come and around this notion of community. And you were part of a very interesting chapter in the judicial history of Scott County, where I think you and others were trying to look at the law through a lens of community in different ways. And I've always been intrigued by how that came together, maybe the fits and starts along the way, and where it sort of led judicial perspective. But tell me a little bit about these extraordinary courts that you helped to set up.
Well, the first court. They call these program courts.
Program.
Because it's different from regular criminal court, because usually in criminal court, we do guilty pleas, and we only see the defendant at time of sentencing after we read what's called a pre-sentence investigation, and we have a short colloquy with the defense attorney, the prosecutor, and the defendant, and we, based on that, we issue a sentence. It could be anywhere from a deferred judgment to incarceration. Back in those days, I think the first drug court nationwide was in the 80s. And Judge Gary McKendrick, who, by the way, was appointed right after I was, because he was the second judge that I went up with the second time, he and Mike Fitzsimmons and Jeff Fall, who were two probation officers, decided that this would be a good idea. The chief judge at that time also encouraged that process, and they went to various seminars throughout the country to find out what drug court was all about, and they started it, and slowly they got individuals that were suffering from addiction into the court system. And what they did was they were identified by the probation officers first, usually by going and interviewing people in the Scott County Jail or any other jail for that matter. And they then decided that they were viable candidates. It's a team approach, which means you have probation officers, the judge, and sometimes other individuals in the community that participate in the decision-making process to determine whether or not these candidates are viable candidates to go through the drug court process. Once they're in there, they then it's a rigorous program. The probation officers usually contact them several times per week. They enroll them in various treatment programs or require them to go to recovery programs, 12-step programs, and so forth, as well as getting their GED, getting employment, and obviously avoiding drugs and alcohol. Mm. That process was really beneficial to those candidates who were basically able to go through that 18-month, usually 18-month to two-year program. Mm-hmm. At the end of it, they had a graduation ceremony, and the families of these defendants usually came, and they, as well as a lot of the court personnel. It was really, even the sheriff came usually.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times the programs through the jail really helped them be successful. And that was really a moving time. And I watched them as a judge because I always wanted to find out what this program was about. And I was really enthralled with that idea.
Well, and, you know, I think one of the questions that you probably encountered was, you know, does this have a positive impact? And I think at least my understanding of the way things are usually is that simply consigning someone with mental health issues, addiction or otherwise, to the penal system probably is retrogressive. It does less good than other things. So did you have a chance to look at how the outcomes were here?
Yes. I think the national average was 50% success, which is much better than people are sent to prison and then get out and get into a work release program. Recidivism is a mm-hmm. big problem.
Sure.
When I say success, I mean that once they graduated, once they got out into the community, and as they say, it were off paper, whether or not they were successful. And a lot of times the graduates would come back into drug court as mentors. It's the old wounded healer
approach. Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of times those individuals were more beneficial to the current participants than would be the probation officers or the judge or anybody else that was involved in a drug court team. They usually told their story, how they got into drug court and the sordid situation they had before that. And then they would indicate how they proceeded through drug court and how successful they had been after that. Mm-hmm. And that made a great impression on a lot of folks.
Well, the British social psychologist Johann Hari has summed it up as briskly as I think you can. He said that the opposite of addiction is community. And this notion of, I mean, usually the penal perspective is separate the offender from community, move them away, sequester them. And I'm learning a lot more about this by being on the very fringes of Augustana's prison education program at the East Moline Correctional Center. And it's a totally different outlook to say, no, some of these offenders, given the nature of why they came into the court system, they need to be moved closer into a community to have that accountability. And I will say, I did go to one of those graduation ceremonies. It was an acquaintance of mine who had gone through and had asked me to come and be there. And that person is now still, I think, doing great and working as a professional clinician of some sort in helping other people that are at treatment centers and that sort of thing. So, yeah, wonderful. And did it spread beyond drug-related things?
Yes. The other thing we tried to do initially, I think it was about 2015 or so, the idea of a mental health court came to mind. And it had, again, started somewhere out east, I think. But the chief judge was intrigued as to whether or not we could start one here. And I was assigned, as well as my spouse at that time, to participate in a team effort that was we were hoping to create a mental health court. Well, we started from the top down, which means that there were judges, there were people, leaders in the community, as well as the sheriff, and as well as the police departments in various jurisdictions, and that they were all part of the team. The problem with that was we had no grassroots support because we didn't try to cultivate that. And finally, at the end of it, we decided we had no funding. We couldn't find a funding source, and we had no real program to demonstrate to the grassroots community how we're going to proceed. So that was a failure. Hmm. We didn't end up having a mental health court. And after that, I'd say about 4 or 5 years after that, the chief judge was contacted by Leslie Kilgannon from Quad City Interfaith. And they had a group that decided that we needed a mental health court in this community. And that was grassroots. They had a upswelling of people that were enthused about it. Leslie was a key person that went to various groups to get funding.
She is a force of nature. She is.
She is definitely a force, and she still is.
She still is?
And she got money to pay for the mental health professionals that we needed to start this program. And the chief judge knew I was interested in this area, this program court area, and she asked me, Chief Judge Grieve asked me whether or not I was interested in starting the program. And I went to some conferences and found out that the success rate was pretty good. It was about 50% nationwide. And there was a need for it. I had been in contact through my role as a judge with people who suffered from mental health. Mm. And the biggest mental health institute in this district was the Scott County Jail.
Wow.
Which is no place to put a person right. suffering from mental health. I had one instance where I had a defendant who was, he just was joyriding in a Jeep and he was arrested for theft. He was in jail and he suffered from schizophrenia and he was off his medication. And he stood in the cell for 3 days straight, stood up to the point where he got a severe infection in his feet. He was taken to the hospital. I was appalled. When he, I had the defense attorney come in, the prosecutor, and indicated that this person suffered enough and we need to address this joyriding charge, which is what it was. He didn't intend to steal the car. And that's just one instance. My colleagues have several other situations back then that these people did not need to be in jail. They were committing crimes because they were either off their medication or suffered from mental illness and were not diagnosed.
Yeah.
And they ended up in jail for reasons that they just did things because of their mental health issue that normally wouldn't occur.
Yeah. You know, I recall the early mid 80s, and I was still, you know, in college and hadn't really opened my eyes very much beyond the campus life. But I recall the movement that was underway in the country and wondering, how is this going to end? And it started through the Reagan first Bush years, where it was, let's just get the federal government out of a lot of things that it had been doing. And so its support for things like mental health started to dry up, and we'll transfer that to the states. And of course, the states were unevenly equipped to deal with that. And I know in Illinois, they started closing residential treatment facilities for people with mental illness, as most states did, because then they thought, well, this isn't really something that we want to spend taxpayer dollar on, so let's shift it then further down. And it came up on communities like counties, and of course, they didn't have the facilities for the most part, and so jails became mental health institutions. And not that they had any treatment, but they were just for the warehousing. And I remember thinking, this is not going to end well. And there have been lots of adjustments along the line. And what I see happening now is almost a renaissance of that. In Illinois, it was terrible because, you know, everything had to be put on the backs of property taxes to pay for education and social services, right? And, state agencies had to rely more and more on private charity-driven institutions. And now, you know, what we're and people have heard me kvetch about this in the past with, you know, the state of Iowa cutting its revenues as a very politically popular thing to do, but then telling cities, no, we're going to cap your property taxes so you can't make up for the shortfall. I see another train wreck barreling down the tracks, and I don't know how that's going to end. It's going to hit education first, but it's going to hit mental health too.
The Scott County Jail, I'm not trying to say that they're not without treatment. They do have great programs, right. and it didn't used to be that way. When I first started practicing law as a defense attorney, the old jail, legal aid and I we sued the old jail for cruel and unusual punishment. They used to call it the bloody stairs of the Scott County Jail because some of the jailers would drag a inmate up and down the jail steps, which are metal.
Yeah.
And there was blood. So since then, the programs have been created by, first of all, Denny Connard, who is the sheriff, and the current sheriff. They have programs for criminal thinking, proper conduct in terms of employment, how to fill out a resume. So they do have programs. In fact, is I think they a lot of the programs they have at the Scott County Jail at this time equal or exceed that in the prison system for Iowa. So I think when I said that they were untreated, I didn't mean that they didn't have programs.
Right.
It's just that they weren't set up to address mental health problems.
And to clarify, my point was it wasn't even. You know, some counties had the resources, intellectual and otherwise, to bring to bear about that. But it was left up. It was county by county. If you were in a small county with no resources, and suddenly your jail is the mental health facility. They weren't as well prepared. Right. But I'm grateful that Scott County was, and grateful that you were part of that that initiative to take things another step further. We're going to talk even more about community. My guest is Mark Smith, retired judge who helped be part of these mental health courts and drug courts and so on and so forth. But we want to remember that it's spring, but this spring has not quite fully sprung. So as I was thinking, Mark, about what kind of music to play for today, I thought, of course, of Vivaldi, but we couldn't have any normal Vivaldi. So this is a setting of the middle movement of the Spring Concerto from the Four Seasons. Seasons by a wonderful artist named Paul Barton. And it is my hope that you're going to enjoy it just as much as I have. Well, that was Paul Barton doing an interesting piano transcription of the middle movement of Vivaldi's Spring Concerto from Quattro Stagioni, the Four Seasons. And it seems like good music for a day like today. My guest is Mark Smith, retired judge from Scott County. And we've been talking about all manner of things. But one of the things that's been a theme we've been coming back to is the whole notion of community. And that's one of the reasons I really was intrigued by your work on those special court programs and how they were about building and incorporating folks into community. I was just part of an interesting little exercise here as part of Augustana's prison education program. We had an outside expert, he's from Philly, who does this around the country, a reentry simulation about how hard it can be for people to leave incarceration and some challenges that are almost intentionally put in their way. You were talking about recidivism. And so the way this exercise works, we had about 100 or so students who were given a small portfolio as describing them who their character was and having to face the challenges that they were going to face coming back. And one of the things that I found just astonishing, Mark, is that when people come out of jail systems in Illinois, Iowa, really everywhere, as often as not, they're not given any identification. And so the first thing they have to do is reestablish their personhood, you know, in a legal sense with the state. And it would seem to me that would be one thing we could maybe tick off their list of things to do if they've been in the penal system for a long time. I was shocked by that.
Yeah, identification is always an issue, and that's part of the program courts. That's what they try to line them up with, getting an identification so they can seek employment. Or do anything else for that matter.
Right, so. Right. Well, and then that whole notion of a community. What better way to separate a person further away from community by saying that, you know, in the eyes of the state, you don't really exist yet. You have to go back and redo that. I was intrigued by another quote that I had come across on this whole notion of community from George Bernard Shaw, There's a respected voice who talks about the futility of seeking happiness, that the world somehow owes you happiness. And he summed it up by saying, I'm of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community. And as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. And he goes on to say that that's what created for him happiness. And I know from Mark, I know that you do a lot of things for the good of the community, even in retirement. And maybe now you've got more time to do stuff like that. But tell us about some of the things that you're engaged in now that you, or maybe you started while you were still judge, but some of the organizations that you're part of.
First of all, being a judge, I considered it an honor, and this community allowed me to do that. So I was interested in giving back, and what I was on the maternal health center to begin with on the board for a while, and I went on the Center for Alcohol and Drug Services board for a while, and before Unity Point took that over, and I'm still on the State of Iowa Iowa Lawyers Assistance Program, which helps lawyers who are suffering from mental health issues or addiction or anything. And the other thing that I am hopefully going to be on the board for, the board hasn't voted yet, but Tapestry Farms, that's my avocation, is growing things.
Yes.
And they have that's a really an interesting nonprofit. It was started by Ann McGlynn.
Yes.
And she used to be a reporter for the Quad City Times,
right.
And
I've got to get her on the show.
You
I'm glad
should.
You
she was really an interesting, she is really an interesting person.
Yeah.
She's a dynamo.
Of course.
And she created this entity. She started out with at St. Paul Lutheran helping refugees. And she decided that this would be something that she could do in addition to growing things by having urban farms. Mm-hmm. And what happens is these refugees come in to this community, and she finds, the staff, and she finds them employment, finds them a place to live, maybe get some ethnic food that's not available, and helps them in that regard. They just started a hydroponic setup, which is located at the Botanical Center.
Right. It's in a truck, right?
Yeah, it's in a container.
Yeah, okay.
It's a container ship type.
Yeah, yeah.
And that just kicked off in January. And that we're hoping to eventually get it to the point where it brings in cash to the agency to help these refugees acclimate to this community. And this community has been a great, they find these people and they bring them in, and the community has open arms. They have a tremendous amount of support trying to find employment and housing and so forth. And it's just part of giving back. So.
Well, while you're chatting, I just wanted to make sure that in case folks are listening and want to learn more, they have a wonderful website, and it's simply tapestryfarms.org. So that's a great thing. And you mentioned your interest, your passion about growing things. So here's a kid from in the city of Davenport. How did you cultivate that interest, and where has that led you?
Well, my grandfather was a farmer.
Okay.
He was a farmer near Durant, owned 160 acres, and he grew up during the Depression as, didn't grow up, but he had my mother during the Depression.
Yes, right.
And he lost his farm back then, but he slowly got enough cash together by working at a factory to buy another farm, and that's where I spent a lot of my summers. And that's where I started the interest in growing things. That's what I was interested in gardening. And my kids and I planted three or four acres of trees by hand using planting nuts. And that was back in the early 80s and through the 90s.
Yeah.
And
so they've got to be maturing now.
I'll be 120 when they're mature enough to harvest. So. Can't wait.
That's right.
I still own nine acres of that. It was started with 27, but we sold the house and the part of the acreage. But they still like to come out when they come visit. They still like to go out to the land and see what the trees are doing and so forth. So
it's, isn't that something?
It is great. I just love being outdoors, I guess.
Well, yeah. And what else do you do on that land? I mean, besides the trees, are you able to grow other things?
Or? Yeah, I've got, well, first of all, I had to, it seems like I work out there 5 days a week because the invasives are always there.
Yeah.
Garlic mustard and everything else that's been brought in without thinking.
Honeysuckle
yeah. is, but I've also got 3 or 4 acres of prairie grass, and I planted some forbs with that, and so that also is something that's really something to watch.
Have you done a burn?
I have.
Wow.
And I learned early on that if you're going to do a burn, you better have more than one person.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because one of the burns, it left the barrier when the wind picked up, and I had to call a neighbor to come and help me. So. But since then, that was my first experience. So,
wow, what a riot. Now, what kinds of trees, if I may ask?
Well, the kids and I planted walnut and oak.
Okay.
So we have a walnut about 3 acres of walnut trees.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is white pine, white spruce. Unfortunately, about a third of it was ash, which is no longer.
That's right.
And we have 2 types of oak, red oak and white oak. It's a beautiful area at this point. So,
well, one of the great things about getting to serve on the Rock Island County Forest Preserve Commission is learning to distinguish red and white oak. And we actually have a couple of black oaks, too. They're a little harder to spot, but they're lovely trees as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think they do quite as well.
Yeah, I went to a master forester seminar, and that's what red oaks have pointed leaves at the end.
Yeah.
White oaks have rounded
leaves. Rounded ones.
Yeah.
Well, when you're talking about planting these trees over time, my grandfather, after he and my grandmother moved to Peoria, they joined a little Lutheran church down there, Salem Lutheran, which is right by I-74. You'd never, if you weren't looking for it, you wouldn't know. But when he took his turn as chair of the property committee at Salem Lutheran, he planted 9 pine trees around the parking lot for each of his 9 grandkids. Mm-hmm. And now they're pretty monumental as those grandkids go into their 60s, right? But whenever I'm driving through Peoria, I always look over to the parking lot of Salem Lutheran and see if I can count in a quick glimpse the 9 pine trees that are there. Mark, this has been so much fun. We've talked about a lot of different things, but what have we left on the table? What's not yet talked about that we need to be discussing?
I think we've covered the whole gamut, Guy.
Does that quote by Shaw, does that resonate with you?
It does. I think community to me is identifying the similarities as opposed to the differences.
Yeah.
And if you can agree on a similarity and focus on that, community usually, whether it be a small entity such as an agency or United Nations, something that usually works.
Well, there was another thought that was shared by the Reverend Dennis Holtschneider, who was the president of DePaul University for a long time. And he said that the mark of a healthy community is that it leads with curiosity, not outrage. Right? So a community that's on the defense, right, has to be outraged with everything. So I try to take that little lesson in wherever I can that, you know, I've got to be more leaning towards curiosity than outrage if I want to be part of a healthier community. So
yeah. I agree.
Yeah. So are you going to take advantage of this beautiful weather to get out to that acreage today?
I am.
As well you should, because it's going to be pretty sloppy for the next couple of days.
I think so.
After that. Well, I really want to thank my guest, the retired judge, Mark Smith, for being with us today. And thank you, listeners, for being with us as well. That's going to have to do it for now. And I'm going to invite you to join us next week. My guest will be Max Roach from Rivermont Collegiate. And you're going to hear that here on Quad Cities NPR, WVIK 90.3 FM and HD in Rock Island, and at 95.9 FM K240 DZ in Dubuque. One more look at that forecast. Yeah, this would be a great day to get out and about. Partly sunny skies with a high near 62 degrees. Winds out of the northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. So don't do a prairie burn today, friends, whatever you do. Then we got a lot of rain sneaking in the forecast for Sunday, pretty much through Tuesday. But by Tuesday night, it'll clear. And then guess what? Sunny with a high near 61 by next Friday. Thanks very much for joining us, friends. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is next on your public radio station, then a little look at the news. Stay tuned to WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.